back and says to Judy, the girl with the Bill Bailey voice, have fun in whatever you do. And the rest is torn away. And there was something that I found incredibly beautiful about only having this glimpse into this person's life and never being able to find out more. And I think that this idea of a partial glimpse, or by contrast, a partial obstruction, is a very beautiful idea, because what happens when you only see part of something is that your mind can fill in the things you don't see with experiences from your own life. And I think in the end, that thing ends up resonating more. So this technique of partial obstruction is something that you'll see a lot in the later work. So this led to programming, which was what I studied at university in the US at Princeton. I studied computer science, and this was very much not my nature at first. I was really this kind of romantic who kept sketchbooks and read lots of literature and things like this, and the very idea of machines and programming was kind of anathema to me. But for some reason, I was drawn to it also. This was my thesis project in university called Extra Extra. This was in 2002. And this was basically a primitive version of Google News that performed article clustering on news articles of similar topics, so that when you were looking at, say, a bombing in Jerusalem, you could see what the Palestinian perspective was, what the Israeli perspective was, what the Japanese perspective was, all side by side. And so this was my thesis project there. And this also represented the first time that I would use computer programs to collect information from the world to try to paint some kind of a portrait of that world, which is a theme that you'll see much more overtly later. Then came infographics. I started to become interested in design and in wrangling this information, which sometimes came from static sources and sometimes came from dynamic sources, into sensibly designed, beautiful experiences that could be looked at. And originally this was happening in print, and my final year at university, just on my own time, not for an assignment or anything, I did a series of seven of these infographic maps that dealt with different issues that were important to the world, in my view, either at that moment or that would become important going forward. This one here deals with transportation, and it has all sorts of statistics on how people around the world get around. And so there's this basic wheel with the primary means of transportation inscribed around it. The most common means of transportation by far in the world by an order of magnitude is the bicycle, which is pictured here on a plateau in Tibet. I also did one on the US government, which was called the Government Grind. This shows every single government job in the United States. So the numbers are how, the size of each number is how many people have that job. The red ones with guns next to them are jobs that are licensed to carry firearms. Interestingly, you know, there's some ones you would expect, like the Secret Service and the police and the Forest Service. But interestingly, in the bottom left corner, you see the IRS. Those are the people that collect taxes, are also licensed to carry firearms. It's a little bit troubling. So I also did this one on the arms trade, which dealt with different ways that weapons are used and the industrial complex happens, both in America and around the world, to prop up economies based on military spending. You can see the military budgets of a variety of countries there in the bottom right, with the US just towering above everybody else. You can also see the nuclear family, the countries that have nuclear stockpiles and how large those are. Then I did one on the global tobacco trade, which shows cigarette smuggling routes throughout the world, and on the left it shows ingredients that go into a typical cigarette and other products that those ingredients appear in, including Mr. Clean floor cleaner, toenail polish remover, rat poison, things like that. So if any of you are smokers, you might have a closer look at this one. After that came interactive information visualization. So I stopped working with these static prints that would display information, and I started to try to bring these to life somehow. And one of the early projects that explored this was a very, very simple project done in 2003 called Word Count. And this one is basically a visualization of a static text file of the most frequently used 88,000 words in the English language. And this is a file that I had worked with during that thesis project, Extra Extra, and I was aware that it was interesting, but in its current format of being a long text file, it was completely unbrowsable and inaccessible. And so I wanted to make something that would bring this data more to life. So I built this project Word Count, which very, very simply visualizes the 88,000 most frequently used English words as a very long sentence, placing them side by side. And then each word is scaled to represent its commonality of usage in the language. So you see the is the most common word, followed by of, and, to, a, n, and then it rapidly peters off to much smaller usages after that. This graph here represents the whole English language, and you can click any position on the graph, and then the word list will zoom to that point, and you can see the sequence of words that occur there. Again, the sequence of words is just based purely on data. There's no editing going on here. And one thing that was interesting is that people started finding conspiratorial phrases in this data set. And they would start emailing me, insisting that there was some conspiracy afoot. But there's not, of course. It's just an artifact of having so many words side by side. You end up having some sequences that seem too good to be true. So, for instance, if I type in America, we can see that America Insure Oil Opportunity. And then if I type in Microsoft, you can see that, Microsoft Acquire Salary Tremendous. And then my favorite one, it's just a two-word sequence, but it's just so good. If I type in Construction, there's construction ahead. And what was interesting about word count was that this inexplicably got a huge amount of attention when it launched, and did so, and continues to actually to this day, but especially for the first 6 months or so, it was getting a ton of use. And one thing that I noticed was that people who used word count would never ever search for the most frequently occurring words. Nobody searched for the, nobody searched for a or an or it. What people searched for, without exception, was first their names, then their friends' names, and then sometimes even before that, they would search for all of the words you can't say on television. And I was wondering if this was just a side effect of my friends who happen to be, you know, dirty people, or whether this was a more prevalent effect. And so I created another project which would try to unveil this question. And so word count tracks the way we use language, and then the sister project query count tracks the way we use word count. So this shows the most frequently occurring, the most frequently searched words. Love, shit, fuck, God, I cunt, you know. It's kind of amazing. Or maybe not. Dog beside Jesus, hello. So one thing that was interesting with word count was that when this project first launched, query count, when it launched, word count was already getting a huge amount of traffic. So in those first few hours of query count's existence, it was very, very easy to influence the list of most frequently occurring words. All you had to do was search repeatedly 6 or 7 times for a word, and it would become number one for the first few hours. And this was right around the time the US invaded Iraq for the first time. And I was watching query count for those first few hours, and I noticed that people, maybe one person, maybe several people, were trying to form the sentence, "This war is a fucking mistake," using successive searches of words in that order in word count. And it was just so incredible to me that people would use such an arcane medium to try to express themselves when there are so many other better mediums existing. But I think it's a testament to the fact that people just will try to encapsulate a message into anything that they're given. It's the same reason we see faces in clouds and tree bark and things like this. And what was even more beautiful was that as the hours passed and the overall volume of queries and query count increased, it became harder and harder to influence that list. So slowly that sentence of "this war is a fucking mistake" started to disintegrate, and the words became more and more spaced out, and it was almost like dropping sand into a lake, and it just kind of spread out until it was no longer there. So after doing word count, which deals with a static list of words, I was interested in taking some of these same principles and applying them to a dynamic set of data that would change all the time, constantly updating itself, constantly reflecting what the world was doing at that moment. And that led to a project called 10x10, which was done in 2004. And 10x10 is a very, very simple premise, which is just that every hour it selects automatically the 100 most important pictures and words in the world that hour, based on what's happening in the international news media, as defined by the New York Times, BBC, and Reuters, which was a good stand-in for what the news media was covering. And then it after selecting these 100 words and pictures, it just visualizes them in a grid, And then it saves all the pass grids, so you can go to any hour between November 4th, 2004, I think it began, and today. Some of these images sometimes don't load because of server problems, but it basically forms a grid of 100 pictures, and the 100 words that match each of those pictures are flanking it off to the left here. So this was Wednesday, June 13th, 2007 at 5 a.m., Hamas, Fatah, African, Gaza, force officials, Sudan. And any of these images can be clicked, and then that leads to the headlines that produce the selection of that image, and then you can click again to just see a montage of the image with its word. So it's super, super simple. This is all that it is. And every hour, this is what you see. It's kind of a picture postcard of what's important in the world at that moment. And as I said, you can go back in history to any hour and see what the world looked like at that moment. So it provides this kind of evolving human history that updates itself every single hour. So word count deals with a static, some might say anemic data set, which is language usage. 10 by 10 deals with certainly a human data set, which is news, but it's mediated by the media. It's distanced in some way. It doesn't feel real the same way that going on dates and falling in love and spending time with your family and your friends feels real. And that really became the next forefront that I was interested in exploring. And it led to a body of work that I'm probably most well known for, which is this kind of work that tries to humanize the web. And at this point in 2006, it was actually earlier than that, it was early 2005 when I started thinking about this stuff, the web was quite a different place than it is today. Facebook wasn't really around, MySpace hadn't really started, blogs hadn't really gotten going yet to the same way they are now, the whole social networking thing hadn't really taken hold. And the web, to many people, still seemed like a very cold, inhuman place, literally this connected web of machines. But what I noticed was that it actually wasn't like that at all. There was tons of human expression happening out there. It was just happening in all of these far-flung nodes, and it was hard to kind of wrangle it all together and see it as one. And so I was very interested in trying to paint the web as a human place that was where all that data was not just data, but it was actually the footprints of humans. So one of the early challenges with that was, how do you take this stuff, which is just a total mess, and make some beauty out of it? This is a selection of MySpace profiles. We've all seen MySpace profiles. They're some of the most, sinfully ugly things that you could imagine producing, although they do have a certain individualistic charm to them. But how do you take something like this out in the wild, which is just a total mess, and add some kind of structure and poetry and beauty to it? And not just MySpace, but all the other umpteen, places online that people would express themselves. And so this led to this project, We Feel Fine, which tries to take the emotional temperature of the internet every 3 or 4 minutes. So the way that We Feel Fine works is that every 3 or 4 minutes, it scans the world's newly posted blog entries, searching for occurrences of the phrases, I feel and I am feeling. And when it finds one of those phrases, it grabs the full sentence up to the sentence boundary and sticks it in the database, and also tries to identify as much demographic information as it can about the author of that sentence. So what's their gender, what's their age, where do they live, what was the weather like when they wrote that sentence. And it sticks all of that data, normalized, into a database. And this database collects on the order of around 18 to 20,000 new feelings every single day. And it's been running for about 4.5 or 5 years now, and it's collected around 11.5 million feelings in all. And so then the question is, what do you do with all of this information? It's just rows in a database. So this is We Feel Fine. What you see here is a swarming mass of colored particles. Each of those particles represents a single person's stated emotion that was posted on a blog in the last few hours. The color of each dot represents the kind of feeling inside. So the brighter ones are happier, and the darker ones are more sad and morose. The diameter of each dot represents the length of the sentence inside. So the very, very small dots are very, very short sentences. The larger ones are bigger sentences. I was feeling a lot better, short one. I wake up seeing him looking at me in the morning. I feel I'm in a pretty good mood. That was from a female. I also wonder what could have possibly pissed someone off that much, and how the people who were closest to that person feel, knowing they were totally failed in whatever role they played in the person's life. I feel a bit tipsy. And some of the feelings have images inside. I went for the dirty look. I feel it suited the situation. Oh, it did. And so when a blog post contains a feeling sentence and also contains a photograph, those two things are paired together, creating what's called a montage composition. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. So this movement here is called Madness. There's six movements in We Feel Fine. And in Madness, you can see that the dots exhibit certain human qualities. So for example, curiosity. So the dots, as the mouse is remaining motionless, are becoming curious about it and looking at it. If I move it away, they lose interest and go back to their business. If I click the background without touching a feeling, they exhibit fear and they run away. And this is a very important principle in the work that I do, which is that the way that something is expressed visually corresponds to the thing being expressed. So there should be a symbiosis there. And in this case, these are human feelings, so it's very important that these dots seem to emote the same way that a human would emote. So there's other movements, as I said. The next one is called Murmurs, which causes the feelings to appear in reverse chronological order as sentences. I feel really attracted to Nicholas. I feel better, so that is good. I feel like a nerd making a Lord of the Flies reference like that. I feel good with this new do. I feel like a giddy teenager. I feel 60-ish. And you can click any of these to go out and visit the blog from which it was collected. So you can reach out to these people if you like. Montage isolates all of the feelings that contain photographs, as I mentioned earlier, and constructs these montage compositions. And any of these can be opened up. I feel sexy wearing them under my clothes, especially at work. I feel I am more creative now since I don't have the pressure. I feel like we might have been talking about taco meat. And you see this little heart down here which says save send. So what that allows you to do is if you click that, it automatically forms a JPEG out of this montage composition, which you can then email to your friends. And when that occurs, it is also automatically entered into an online gallery consisting of all of the montages that have been explicitly saved by the viewers of We Feel Fine. So in that way, the viewers of the piece over time kind of turn into curators as they choose their favorite content, and those are entered into this gallery. Mobs is the next movement, which shows you some statistical insights into the feelings. So this is showing you the most common feelings in the last few hours. Better is number one. It turns out better is almost always the most common feeling, followed by good and bad, also very typical. Sorry, well, sick. You can see a gender breakdown, so women are emoting slightly more than men at the moment. That's also typical. An age breakdown shows you a histogram of the age distribution of the feelings. So it's predominantly people in their 20s, followed by teenagers, and then some 30-year-olds, some 40-year-olds, some 50-year-olds, and not much other activity. Weather causes the feelings to assume the physical traits of the weather that they represent. So those are the sunny ones swirling around as part of a sunset, the cloudy ones floating along, the rainy ones falling down like rainstorm, and the snowy ones fluttering to the ground. And at any moment, you can stop a raindrop and open it and see, wow, it's better in my leg too. I see it, there's cancers. Nice. Moving on. So this is location, which causes the feelings to move to their positions on a world map, boners and all. You see it's only an English language project, so it's predominantly North America, Australia, the UK, and then some other assorted activity around the world. Metrics is a more numeric look at things, so you can see the most statistically improbable feelings at the moment. Lucky is leading the way at the moment, occurring at 4.1 times the normal level, followed by big, uncomfortable, home, sorry, and so on. The last movement is called Mounds, which presents the most common feelings in the whole history of the project as these large gelatinous jelly blobs. And if I hold down the mouse, they kind of dance a little bit. And And so Better is the biggest blob, followed by Bad and Good. But there are tons and tons of these blobs, as there are tons and tons of feelings. There are about 5,000 feelings tracked by We Feel Fine, which are basically adjectives, as defined by the Webster's Dictionary. And then we hand-edited that list. And as you get to the end, the feelings become more and more obscure until you can see you know, the 71 people feeling belittled, or the 71 people feeling prone. That would be interesting. And so on. There's also a search capability, so if you want to narrow into a really, really specific population, you know, these are all the feelings here, so you can check out women feeling panicked or paranoid in their 30s in the rain in Brazil on a certain date. You know, there's a lot of ways to slice and dice this because there are, in fact, so many feelings. So what I'm going to show you now are some of the montage compositions automatically created by the project that I like the most. There have been hundreds of thousands of these created, and these are some that I think are especially beautiful. Maybe we could dim the lights a little for this. Thanks. I feel like I'm diagonally parked in a parallel universe. I feel so much of my dad alive in me that there isn't even room for me. I have kissed numerous other boys, and it hasn't felt good. The kisses felt messy and wrong, but kissing Lucas feels beautiful, almost spiritual. I feel like Andrew has abandoned me. I understand how it feels to be rejected. I just want to feel alive for the first time in my life. I feel so happy. Man, this had better last. I can feel my cancer grow. I cried in my pillow that night for hours, feeling angry, disappointed, and frustrated, knowing I would never get to see my father again. I feel loved. I feel free. I feel pretty. I need to be in some backwoods redneck town so that I can feel beautiful. I feel skinny, but I'm not. I wouldn't hide it if society didn't make me feel like I needed to. I'm 23 and a recovering meth and heroin addict and feel absolutely blessed to still be alive. Can't wait to see them racing for the first time at Daytona next month because I feel the need for speed. I feel sassy. I feel so naughty. I feel so sexy in this new wig. I feel these weirdos are actually an asset to college life. The masking tape Superman logo. I feel like I'm in the center of that light circle. I love how I feel today. And so, with time, as I mentioned, So with time, as I mentioned, the database for this project has grown very, very large, and it's reached around 11 and a half feelings now, and representing about 5 years of expression on the web. And a lot of academics have expressed interest in this data set because it's just so much huger than anything they're used to working with. You know, most psychologists and sociologists and anthropologists deal with data sets on the order of 100 or 500 or maybe 1,000 people at the most. And here we have 11 million data points. So we've shared our whole database with a number of different academics around the world at various universities. And these are some interesting findings that a few of them have come back with recently. This is actually being proposed to Nature as a paper for the moment from some guys from the University of Vermont. So this graph here is showing the volume of happiness over time. And this is not just people saying, I feel happy. This is a whole host of positive feelings. I feel happy, I feel good, I feel great, I feel okay, I feel better. And they call this valence. And this is the vector of the growth of happiness over time. And you see that it actually is growing. And so over the last 3.5 years, you see this constant steady slope. There are some interesting traits. There seem to always be peaks at Christmas time, which is generally the happiest time of the year. And there also seem to be dips and valleys in the summertime. I'm not sure why that is, but we call this the summertime blues. They've also noticed some other interesting things. So happiness over age, there's very, very sharp increase in happiness through one's teens and 20s. It plateaus in your 30s and stays constant until your 40s, and then there's another little peak into your 50s where it peaks overall and then starts to decline into old age. Interestingly, happiness over the course of a single week peaks on a Sunday and bottoms out on a Wednesday, and it's just a constant approach towards that peak with no variation. So just a few interesting insights. So We Feel Fine deals with humans' feelings, as you know. It looks in people's blogs, people's diaries to find this stuff. And as I said at the outset, one of the original ideas here was to humanize the web, to show the human traits of the internet. And one of the best places to look for that is in people's diaries, where people are being very honest and candid. But there's another great place to look for this humanity on the web, too, and that is the world of online dating. So there are countless people, probably around 10 or 12 million people by some estimates, using online dating sites around the world over the last few years. And this is a project that explores those people. It explores people searching for love on the internet. And it's called I Want You to Want Me, and it was commissioned by the Museum of Modern Art in New York for a recent show that they had there. And this is not a website, it's a large interactive touchscreen installation on which is displayed a sky with real weather system with rain and clouds and sunsets and snow and everything. And through this sky are flying hundreds of pink and blue balloons. And each of those balloons represents a single person's dating profile, a real person. The pink ones are women, the blue ones are men. The darker balloons are older people, the brighter balloons are younger people. And you can touch the screen and touch any balloon, and when you touch a balloon, it comes to the forefront and freezes and spawns a little thought bubble above it, which contains text from the person's dating profile. And so this is a kid using the installation at the moment. We also filmed 600 video silhouettes of people doing all sorts of mundane or not so mundane domestic activities, the type of things you would do alone in your bedroom, maybe when you're waiting for your date to call. And we put an ad on Craigslist, and we rented out a studio in Brooklyn for 3 days, and we had an open casting call, and people came in, and they brought props, and it was a big party, and we had music, and it was a lot of fun. And we shot about 600 people doing things. And then we blacked them out and turned them into silhouettes, kind of like iPod ads, and put a little silhouette inside each of these balloons, so that when you touch a balloon and look at it, there's actually a little domestic mini-drama unfolding inside the balloon. And these mini-dramas range in length from a few seconds to a few minutes, depending on the complexity. There are a number of different movements in the piece which show different aspects of the data. This one pictured here is called Matchmaker, where we have an algorithm that automatically pairs people together based on the language they're using in their dating profiles. Polaroid photos also dangle down on strings when you select a balloon, and they're the real dating profile photos of the person. This is another view. This is the movement called Closers, which causes the balloons to form a grid. These are four of the movements, moving left to right. There's What I Want, which is a large pulsing heart, which shows people talking about their desires. There's Openers, which is a field of bursting flowers, all balloons, of course, which shows people's opening lines. There's Taglines, which is a DNA double helix spinning in space, and this shows people's subject lines. And then there is finally Breakdowns, which has these clusters of balloons snaking into the distance, and this shows you the zeitgeist of dating. So you can see things like the most common turn-ons, the most popular first date activities, the most popular desires, and things like this. This is a shot from the opening day at MoMA as it looked installed on the wall there. And so, since it's not a website, I can't show you it live, but I'm going to show a video that's about 4 minutes long that will give you a pretty good idea of how the piece is. So maybe if we could do the lights again. Thank you. Thank you.
the search for love, but also the search for self in the world of online dating.
Every few hours, we pull data from online dating sites all over the world. We put these dating profiles in a database. We do several different movements, and each of these movements explores a different topic. One movement explores who people are, and that's called who I am. One movement explores what people are looking for, that's called what I want. And we allow people to search through them by saying, like, I'm interested in seeing what women in their 20s are like, and I want to see what men in their 60s are looking for.
So the blue balloons are men, and the pink balloons are women, and the darker balloons are older people, and the lighter balloons are younger people.
Whereas all the other movements are very, very chaotic, with all of these balloons careening around the screen, Matchmaker offers finally some resolution. So in Matchmaker, we algorithmically pair people together based on what they say in their profiles. So the next movement is called Snippets, and it actually consists of three smaller movements. Snippets takes little text snippets from people's dating profiles out of context. In this case, this is called Openers, and this is showing the opening lines from people in their dating profiles.
This particular movement is the closing statements of all the profiles. And this movement is the movement that you can see the silhouettes best. So each of these are a silhouetted person, and they represent people trapped inside balloons looking for love.
Taglines is going to take the text snippet that is the subject line of the people's profile and then put them all in this DNA double helix here, which is kind of the symbol of identity.
So one thing that's interesting with these is you see half of these are men, half of these are women, and this represents the population on dating profiles. So this last movement is called breakdowns. And what we do is we then say, what are some ideas about the population in general, or what are some information about the population in general? So for example, what are the top first dates? A lot of people like to go to coffee. A lot of people like to go to a movie.
In online dating profiles, what people do is they talk about themselves in maybe 200 words, and they say the most important things about themselves. And so it's a very fertile ground for building a mosaic of humanity.
Check out the top turn-ons now. So intelligence is the number one turn-on for people overall, followed by confidence and a nice smile, and then smarts. A sense of humor is important too, as is a good body and kissing. Thanks. So the other voice on there is my friend and collaborator, Sep Kambar, who's a mathematician and computer scientist from Stanford, and we collaborate a lot on projects. So the next kind of work that I'm going to talk about is work that involves real experience, so getting away from the computer and getting out into the world and doing stuff, and then maybe coming back to the computer at the end as a way to present the project, but the main part of it doesn't actually happen with code. So last May, I went up to a place called Barrow, Alaska, which is the northernmost settlement in the United States. And for 10 days, I lived with a family of Inupiat Eskimos during their annual spring whale hunt. And it's very cold up there. It's about negative 22 degrees Fahrenheit all the time. And the sun never sets this time of year. And basically what happens is they go out onto the frozen ice of the Arctic Ocean and set up whale camp, wait for whales to swim by. This is our whale camp. This is the Putkatuk family. It's the family I was staying with. And we're about 6.5 miles from shore here, camping on 6 feet of pack ice. And that water that you see there is actually not the open ocean, it's what's called the lead. So what happens when the ice breaks in the springtime is that at first a small crack emerges in the ice, and this reveals a canal of water. And at first this canal of water is just a couple of feet wide. But gradually that canal widens and widens until it's huge. And at this point, this canal was about 9 miles wide. But out there on the horizon is actually floating a huge sheet of ice. And if the wind were to change directions, that sheet of ice could come sliding back in towards land, and it would smash up about a mile and a half of pack ice and kill you. So you have to be very, very careful about what the wind is doing. Also for polar bears, there's always a guy on guard with a rifle in case they come along. And it basically involves a lot of waiting. You sit out there on the ice, and you wait for a whale to swim by, and when one swims by, you throw a harpoon at it and try to haul it in and cut it up. And what I did is, for this whole trip, starting with my studio in Brooklyn, continuing on with the flights to get up to Alaska, and continuing for 8.5 days until the butchering of the second whale, I saw two whales killed, I took a photograph every 5 minutes. So when I was awake, I had a camera around my neck, and every 5 minutes I'd take a picture of something, whatever was happening. And while I was asleep, I had a tripod with a timer trained on me, and every 5 minutes it would take a photograph of me sleeping. But when exciting things were happening, and I could feel my heartbeat quickening, I would increase that rate to as much as 40 photographs in 5 minutes. And so what this produced was a sequence of photographs that more or less matched my own heartbeat. I call it a photographic heartbeat. And this sequence of photographs tells the story of this whole trip, every moment, eating, peeing, sleeping, waiting around, also seeing whales get killed. And so part of what interested me here was to subject myself to the same kinds of things I would usually write a computer program to do. For example, following a really simple rule repeatedly over time. And in this case, the rule was take a picture every 5 minutes or more. The other thing this project allowed was to think about the components or the elements that constitute any story. This was a very, very epic story. We Feel Fine, by contrast, deals with very, very small stories, sometimes a sentence or a photograph. The Whale Hunt deals with this epic story. Stories have characters, the people that conduct the story. They have concepts, what's happening. They have contexts, where does it happen? They have colors, what does it look like? Time, when did it happen? Dates, how long did it last? And in the case of the Whale Hunt, also this idea of an excitement moment. And these are traits that could be applied to more or less every story. But if you think about most traditional mediums that we have for telling and sharing stories, things like books, movies, photographs, lectures, radio, all of these things, they're typically defined by a camera position or a narrator. Basically, you have some omniscient being, whether it's a machine or a person, who is telling you the story, and you see the story through that person's eyes. But in real life, it's just not like that. In a sense, each of us is our own narrator, but in another sense, life is this incredibly entangled mesh of all of these overlapping storylines. As we cross one another's paths and diverge and then converge again later, and people fall in love and people get in feuds, and this is how life is. It's just a big tangled mess. So I thought it would be an interesting challenge to try to create some kind of a storytelling framework that could accommodate the telling of those kinds of layered stories. So in the case of this, for example, could you pull out this kind of a story? The story of Simeon and Crawford, involving the concepts of wildlife, tools, and blood, happening on the Arctic Ocean, predominated by the color red, around 10 in the morning on May 3rd, with an excitement level of high, or something as arbitrarily complex as that. And so what I did is I came back from this experience, and I put together this website. This shows here, in this case, a mosaic consisting of all of the photographs taken in the Whale Hunt, 3,214 photographs. They're organized chronologically, beginning with my studio in Brooklyn up here and ending with the butchering of the whales down here 8 days later. You can start to see here some of the stories that color tells you. So this red strip here is the color of the wallpaper in the basement bedroom where I was staying in Barrow for the first two nights. Things go white here as we move out into the Arctic Ocean. There's this narrow strip of yellow, which was the color of the tent wall on the inside. And then there's the reintroduction of red down here as whales are being killed. There's timeline, which shows you the changing heartbeat rate over time, deduced from the number of photographs taken in each 30-minute period. So each of these bars represents 30 minutes. This spike here is when I was getting dressed to go out onto the Arctic for the first time, and all of this activity down here is when whales were being cut up. pinwheel is a slightly more playful representation of the timeline, but showing the same information more or less. And now you can click on any of these rectangles and enter the story at that position. So here we go, and this is Andrew, my friend who came up with me boarding the plane. This is him just telling me a story. This is me taking a nap on the plane as I was reading Moby Dick. This is eating some airplane food. This graph down here is reminiscent of a medical heartbeat graph, and it represents the whole 8.5 days with the spikes representing the exciting moments. This is flying into Anchorage. This is one of the flight attendants on the ground in Alaska. This is the first night up in Barrow, sleeping. This is a restaurant where we had lunch. This is the second night sleeping. This is what the landscape looks like up there. It's just the end of the world. I mean, that's the ocean. And it's just frozen. That's the road right next to it. You can't even really tell the difference between the road and the ocean. Totally bleak. Those are whale bones, which are often propped up all around town as mementos of hunts past. An abandoned car with its door open for some reason. These are these old World War II era bunkers that people shack up in if they're not abandoned entirely. Also around Barrow. This is the scene in the garage, the scene in the living room as people were preparing to go out to camp. This is one of their family friends. This is the umiak, the whale hunting boat, as it's being prepared. Then I'll skip ahead to out on the Arctic Ocean here. This is the snowmobile ride out there. This is where we were set up, right on the edge of the water. This is a tent flap blowing in the wind. The light really changed incredibly. You can see at the beginning it was just sparkling sun. Then with time, the sky started to darken. I was taking a nap here in the tent. This is the dinner. We had a sunset one night, and the sun came up again about 2 hours later. It was incredibly beautiful. This day was sparkling clear. And then slowly, things started to become a little more ominous. Things started to get whiter and whiter. And now you can see the sky is just blank white. And the wind completely died down, which meant that the ice started to freeze over, which is very, very bad for whaling, because if the ice freezes entirely, it means whales can't get up anymore. You can see it's almost turned entirely to slush, and they would actually take the boat out and drive it around and try to break up that ice. Okay, so what I'm going to show you now are some of the ways that you can slice and dice this story. So this is the whole cast. These are all the people involved, including the two whales here at the end. So we can do something like see the story of Roni, who is one of the younger harpooners. These are all the concepts: Moby Dick, kids, games, food, buildings, boats, blood. Let's check out blood. Let's check out whales. These are all the contexts: New York City, airplanes, Barrow, Pukkatuck home, Arctic Ocean. So we'll go to the Arctic Ocean and Akivak camp, which was the neighboring camp, and we can select a heartbeat level of fast, and then we'll enter the story at that position. You can see Roni cutting up the first of the two whales. These whales are about 38 feet long and weighing around 40 tons. It's a whale penis hanging down. And they use only blades, no chainsaws. And over the course of about 4.5 hours, this whale is reduced to a single jawbone just sitting on the ice. And everything else has been cut up into strips and loaded onto snow machines and taken into town, where it will provide the food source for the community for most of the year. There's a quota of 22 whales a year that the Inupiats are allowed to kill. And the whale meat will provide dinner 3 to 4 nights a week for most families in town. And it's shared among the community. This is what the scene looked like from up on an iceberg. These strips that you see here are strips of blubber, or muktuk as they call it. Now they're tying on a rope to the carcass of the whale, which then they're going to tug of war until it rips open so that they can get at all the internal organs. And when that happened, the moment when it split open, this amazing billowing cloud of steam rose up, because the whale's body was so warm and the air was so frigid. The sun started to come out one last time. Those are the strips. The harvest is almost finished at this point. More tug of war trying to pull open the rest of the whale. This is dragging these strips into place. They're incredibly heavy, so they use meat hooks and they drag them along the ice. That's a jawbone. That's really what's left. This is baleen, a piece of baleen. I'll just show you that jawbone again, because that's really all that's left of the whale at the end of the hunt. You just see this thing sitting there on the ice. Anyway, this is online also, so you can see that. So that's the whale hunt. Thank you. So the whale hunt had to do with real experience. It had to do with me putting myself through something incredibly unusual to try to make something out of it. After that, I started trying to work with real people, which I had never done before. I had always written these programs that kind of spy on people, you know, using surveillance, as I said in the original description for this talk. And I thought it would be an interesting change to go and actually talk to people and do something different. So this project is not finished. It's about a month and a half away from being finished, but I'm going to show you a work in progress here. This is a project I did last December in Bhutan, which is a small kingdom in the Himalayas nestled between Tibet on the north and India on the other three sides. And Bhutan is a really, really wacky place. It's a monarchy. It has a king who's down there at the bottom. That's Jigme Singye Wangchuck with his four wives, who are all sisters. And each of the wives maintains her own palace, and they entertain him on alternating nights. And they got a chance to each bear him a son in their birth order. And the second oldest one ended up bearing him the son, so the fifth king. And in the 60s, Jigme Singye Wangchuck, who was very enlightened, he'd studied at Oxford in the West, he noticed that his country was this tiny little anomaly nestled between two rising superpowers, China and India. And that if they didn't quickly become known for something in their own right, they had the chance of being swallowed up by one of their neighbors. And so he was searching for something that his country could become known for, and quickly realized it couldn't be anything economic because they're so small and so poor. And he came up with this idea of gross national happiness, which is Bhutan's alternative to gross national product. So they don't use gross national product to make any kind of national choices in Bhutan. Instead, they use this notion of gross national happiness. And it's a real thing. They have reports. They have a conference in Bangkok every year. They hire all sorts of foreign academics to come in and conduct field studies and make spreadsheets. And it's kind of this whole industry of happiness. You know, a cynic would say it's just putting a marketing slogan around the ideas of Buddhism, which in some way it is, but there's also something there. And I did a lot of research before doing this project, and one of the things that I did was I bought the official Gross National Happiness DVD from Amazon.com, produced by the Bhutan government. And I said, well, this is going to be good. So I put it in, and I had it going on my projector up on the wall in New York. And at first, my first impression was how beautifully produced it was. There was this panorama of the Himalayas moving across, and you know, songbirds singing, and I think there was like a monkey that swang through the frame. And then there was no human voice, and suddenly this booming British narrator comes on, and he says, "Bhutan is the happiest country in the world." And I just thought this was like so ridiculous, you know? Just the earnestness and the self-righteousness with which they treated this topic. So I thought it would be funny to do kind of a zany take on gross national happiness. So I came up with this project concept, which went as follows. I was gonna go around and interview people and ask them to rate their level of happiness between 1 and 10, 1 being very sad, 10 being very happy, which is the kind of thing an academic would ask, but it's a stupid question. I mean, it's stupid. But when they would answer and say a number, like 7 or 8 or something, I would reach into my bag and take out a bag of colored balloons and inflate the number of balloons that would match their level of happiness and hand them the balloons. So you would have these really happy people holding 10 balloons, and like these really sad people just holding one balloon, but it's still a balloon, you know. And then I did a number of other things, like I asked people to tell me what was the happiest moment in their life, and what brings them happiness today, what's their favorite joke, but nobody had a joke, so I stopped asking that. If they were the king of Bhutan, what would they do? And finally, I asked them to make a wish, and when they made a wish, I wrote it onto the balloon of their favorite color, which was, the balloons were the same colors as prayer flags, so it was always a prayer flag color. And then photograph them holding their wish. And this project was intentionally half serious, half silly. And what I'm going to show you now are some of the interviews that I did with people there to give you a feeling. This is with an 11-year-old student. And maybe we'll dim the lights for this part. Thanks. This is with an 11-year-old student. He was running through the streets of this town called Mongar with plastic guns, playing cops and robbers with all his friends. And he had this Snoopy shirt on. His wish was to become a police officer. I also photographed everybody's hands. So each of the questions would match a photograph. So this photograph would match the "What was the happiest moment in your life?" question. I think you can often tell a lot about somebody from what their hands look like. I took also a portrait of everybody, and finally asked everybody to make a funny face, so he pretended to shoot me. As a 17-year-old student. Wish was to have been born a boy. Took me totally by surprise. It was just out of nowhere. A 28-year-old cell phone shop owner. So if you knew what the town of Paro looked like, you would be totally amazed to think that there is a cell phone shop there. But there is, and this guy owns it. He had just finished painting it bright green, so there was really strong fumes when we were talking. His wish was to help poor people. He was married. People get married quite young in Bhutan, often around 16, although he was in his mid-20s. A 53-year-old farmer. She'd been chafing wheat by the side of the road, and this pile had taken her about a week of work to make. She wanted to keep farming until she dies. She had this little silver plastic ring that she was wearing, which had the word love embossed on it, and I asked her if it was some kind of special sentimental thing, and she said, "No, I found it on the road about 8 years ago, but I've been wearing it every day since." Seemed about right. A 16-year-old quarry worker. He was making about $1.50 a day breaking rocks with a hammer. But he wanted to spend his life as a farmer. A 21-year-old monk. The monks all had 10 balloons. They were the happiest people. He wanted to live a long life in the monastery. They also all had the same wish. At first I was so excited to talk to monks, and then by the end it was like, oh no, not another monk. It's like they all got briefed on that. If you see an American asking you. He had this amazing hair growing out of a mole on the side of his face, backlit by the sun, which is supposedly very good luck in Southeast Asian cultures. He was really shy, and so he just kind of giggled when I asked him to make a funny face. A 24-year-old road sweeper. She too was making about $1.50 or $2 a day, and she'd been living for 4 years in a workers' camp on the side of the road in one of those tents made of blue tarps. And this was about 9,000 feet. And very cold, and this was her lunch break. She'd made a little fire there. Her wish was to marry someone with a car. And that broom, that makeshift broom you see there, is what she uses to clean the roads. Tied up with plastic twine. An 81-year-old farmer. This guy is actually an itinerant farmer and didn't have a home. We saw him on the side of the road one night, one of the first days I was there, and asked him to make a wish. And at first he said he was really resistant, he didn't want to make a wish, and kind of pressed him more. This was a translated interview. About 60% of them were done in English, and the others were done with the help of a translator, this guy named Yishi, who was there with me. He's a Bhutanese guy. And Yishi pressed this man and asked, "No, please make a wish. It's okay, you can have a wish." And so he said in Dzongkha, the local language, "It's fine, my wish is to come with you so that I have somewhere to live." And then Yishi translated this to me and kind of took my breath away. I asked him to make a funny face, he whipped this knife out of his go and started brandishing it. And had this Russian hat and an Adidas jacket, amazing, the whole thing. And no teeth on one side of his mouth and perfect teeth on the other side. It's a 10-year-old. wanted to join a school and learn to read. So school is free in Bhutan, but there are some associated expenses, like you have to buy pencils and books and a uniform. And so it's quite typical that a family can only afford to send one of their kids to school. And in those situations, typically the eldest gets to go. And this was his situation. So his older brother was going to school, but they couldn't afford to send him. He had been eating this orange powdered sugar candy when I talked to him, and it was kind of smeared all over his hands. I thought it was so amazing that a kid that age would have the self-recognition and awareness to know that that would be funny. You know, he was kind of doing this, and I said, make a funny face, and he just goes, it's amazing. 37-year-old road worker. These guys were mixing up tar by the side of the road. They're actually from West Bengal in India. They're not Bhutanese, but a lot of the manual labor, a lot of the shitty jobs in Bhutan are handled by Indian immigrants who are then expelled once the job is done. It's a kind of skeleton in the closet of Bhutan. He wanted to make some money and open a store. A 75-year-old farmer. She was selling oranges out of this great big basket. If you look at the prayer flags, you can see how windy it was there. She said, maybe I'll live, maybe I will die, but I don't have a wish. So in many Southeast Asian countries, people chew betel nut throughout their whole lives, which can, over time, cause your teeth to turn very, very red and fall out. And so that's what had happened to her. It's very common among old people in Vietnam and Burma and Bhutan. This was a nun, a 26-year-old nun. This is the last one I'm going to show. This one really stuck with me. She was incredibly beautiful and had been living at this mountaintop nunnery since she was an early teenager, 11 or 12. She was 26 here. And I asked her why she decided to come and live here. She spoke perfect English. She was smart. She was funny. She was like somebody I could hang out with in New York. But here she was living in this nunnery. And she said that when she was 9 years old, her grandfather had instilled in her a very profound fear of death. Specifically a fear of going to hell after death. Not hell as we understand it, but the Buddhist definition of hell, which, you know, not escaping samsara, and had told her that the only way to ensure that she wouldn't have that fate was to become a nun. So when she was 11, she told her family that she wanted to become a nun, and they gradually started the process of emotionally disowning her and she to them. And then when she was a young teenager, she moved into this nunnery and has lived there ever since. And I asked her, I said, what do you plan? I mean, you're 26 now, how long are you going to stay in this nunnery? And she said, well, of course it's impermanent, but my plan is to stay here until I'm 30 and then to enter a hermitage. And I said, a hermitage? Do you mean like a cave? And she said, yeah, like a cave. And I said, wow, and how long will you spend in the cave? And she said, well, I plan to spend the rest of my life in the cave. And that was just a really amazing thing to hear. And so I asked her a little bit more about that. Just to get back to this, she wanted to go to Tibet. That was her wish, and her hands. And so I asked her more about that fear of dying, and this is what she had to say about that.
So I'm really afraid to die.
You're afraid to die?
Afraid of death.
You're afraid of death?
Without religion, without dharma.
Without religion?
Yes.
Are you still afraid of death now that you're here in the night?
No. Of course, but not that much like before.
Yeah. And as your life goes on and you meditate more, do you think you will become less and less afraid of death?
Yes.
That's your hope?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And is that partially why you want to go to live in your cave?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I have to learn see the truth.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, sorry about that. So I asked her about this cave, and I said, you know, you want to spend your life in this cave. What if you live for 35 more years? Are you going to spend 35 years in this cave? And this is what she said about that.
I think I will stay for 35. Maybe.
Maybe you'll die.
Yes.
10 years. 10 years, even, that's a long time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not maybe 10 years, maybe I can die within 1 year or something like that.
Are you hoping to?
Because you know it's impermanent.
Yeah. But yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. Do you hope would you prefer to live in the cave for 40 years or to live for 1 year?
But I prefer for maybe 40 to 50.
40 to 50.
Yes.
Yeah.
From then I'm going to the
yeah.
heaven.
Yeah. Well, I wish you the best of luck with it.
Thank you.
I hope that's everything. Thank you again so much.
You're most welcome.
Yeah, I don't really know what you say to someone who tells you that. You know, it was just like for somebody like me and probably most of us who are brought up with the ethic that you preserve life at all costs and that the goal of a life is to have as much experience as you can and to achieve and accomplish as much as you can. Here was somebody who had a completely contradictory philosophy that was somehow completely consistent with itself and in some ways seemed very wise. And it just really stuck with me. It still does, this interview. And I think about her a lot, actually. So anyway, so there were 117 of these interviews that I did. And each of them, as you know, has a wish at the end, which was on a balloon. And I didn't tie off any of these balloons. What I did is I used these little black binder clips to seal off a balloon once it was inflated. And then that would allow me to deflate the balloon after taking the portraits and carry it with me. So at the end of the trip, I had these 117 deflated balloons with wishes written on them. And I went up to a very sacred place in Bhutan called Dochula, which is a mountain pass at around 10,000 feet. And at Dochula, you come to the crest of this hill, and you suddenly see this panoramic view of the whole Himalayan range, 180 degrees around you, all snow-capped in the distance. And on the top of this hill is a series of pagodas and stupas, about 25 of them. And then all around these stupas on the hillside is a literal spaghetti patch of prayer flags. You've never seen anything like this before. I'm sure you've seen pictures of prayer flags in Nepal and Tibet. This was just like a totally different ballgame. And so with the help of my guide, Yishi, we reinflated the 117 wish balloons and tied them off and attached them all to a long string and then hung that string between two trees right up there amid all the prayer flags at sunset. And I'll show you some pictures of that. Maybe we can do the lights again. You can see the nun's wish there to make a pilgrimage to Tibet. We left the balloons flying up there. I'm sure they're all popped by now, but presumably for a few weeks after this, you could go up to Dochula and see all of these balloons with the wishes of Bhutan strung up between the trees. So this project will be online later this fall. I'm just building a framework to tell the story in the best way possible at the moment. So that brings me to the next part, in some ways the most important part of what I want to say today. As I said at the outset, you know, I don't really speak much at Flash conferences and I'm probably kind of on the periphery of the Flash community myself, but I feel like I have observed it a lot and have a lot of thoughts about it and about the future and what should happen next. And so I want to share some of those thoughts with you today. And they might sound a little hard to hear, maybe, but I think it's good that somebody says this stuff. So first, I'm going to talk a little about the evolution of new mediums. I think that most mediums start and evolve in more or less the same fashion. And I think there's three basic steps. The first step is that there's some spark. There's some technical innovation. This often comes from the world of science. And at first, there's just a very small number of practitioners who are aware of the spark and who use it in some way. And this would be typical of what happened with photography and film, which both started as technological advances before they were used for art or news or anything else that they're now used for. The second phase of a new medium is what I would call the awkward adolescence. This is a phase that's defined by a lot of groping. Businesses grope for how they can use the new medium to make money. Hobbyists grope with how they can use the new medium to have fun. Artists grope with how they can use the new medium to say something that needs to be said about the world, to process reality in some way. And that's the second phase, this awkward adolescence. The third phase happens later, when at first a small number of visionaries and virtuosos emerge. And these are people who have learned the new medium so well and so thoroughly that they are capable of saying things with incredible beauty using this medium. Or they're capable of manipulating the medium in such a way that they can make astounding amounts of money out of business. But these are kind of these virtuosos. And you know, examples of this would be like Stanley Kubrick and Robert Frank, or any kind of internet entrepreneur. When I think about our medium, which I'm not just going to call Flash, I see it as bigger than that. It's this whole way of using the online world to say something important, to express oneself, to do something creative. That's what I'm going to be talking about today, not Flash in particular. But when I think about that medium, I think that we're very much in this awkward adolescence with a lot of groping. I don't think any true virtuosos have emerged yet. Next, I want to say some things about the importance of language and its limitations. So language is basically a system for saying something. And there are all sorts of languages. There are the obvious ones, like English and Spanish and French and Mandarin. And then there are things like dance and photography and film and politics and programming. Those are all languages. They can all be used to say something. And it's very important to learn a language, because if you don't know a language, you can't speak, you can't say anything. And I think it's important to speak. It's important to see something that hasn't been said, that's not being said, and to say it. But to do that, you need to know a language. But languages are a double-edged sword, because they can become very addicting too, and people can spend all of their time obsessing over the language, over learning the language, and they spend so much time doing that they never actually end up saying anything. And once you've learned a language, then comes the most difficult point, but a much more important point, where you have to figure out what you're going to say that with that language. If you don't do that, you're like a schoolboy who spends his whole life memorizing the dictionary, occasionally formulating a sentence, but never putting together a paragraph, a poem, a play, not to mention a novel. And that's a shame if that happens. And when I look at the Flash community, or this online community in general, I see too many of us that are a lot like that schoolboy, groping around for something to say, but really spending most of our time focused just on the language. The language that we speak is powerful. It's new, it's powerful, and it's capable of saying things that no other language can say. But I think that very few people have realized this, and even fewer people have figured out what they're going to say. You know, I look around this room, and I look at some of the people that have graced the stage over the last 3 days, and I see some of the most incredibly talented communicators alive in the world today. I mean, just amazing, amazing people with incredible talent. And I think that these people have the potential to become the great poets and the great communicators of today's world. The way that musicians were, the way that photographers were, the way that filmmakers were. I think we can become those kinds of people. But we have to make a move in that direction. And I see this potential, and this potential is inspiring, but I'm also saddened. I'm saddened by how this potential is being wasted. What I also see is a community that's distracted by the relentless experimentation, by tinkering, by games, by advertising, by purely aesthetic work that has no core concept. And I think this is a shame, and I think this is largely because this community is manipulated by the people that pay money to it, to pay our rents, and it can be very hard to realize that there's a possibility to do something more. And that's what I hope can happen with this community. I think right now there is a lot being said, or there's a lot being spoken. There's a lot of output, there's a lot of productivity, an incredible amount, but very little is actually being said, very little of meaning is being said. I don't think there have been any masterpieces in the online world yet, my own work included. I define a masterpiece as a beautiful idea, fully realized and taken as far as it can go, and I don't think anybody has done that yet. When I look at most of the work, with some exceptions, but when I look at most of the work being produced by this kind of online community, I see work that is mainly devoid of ideas. I see work that's obsessed with slickness, style, beauty, aesthetics, technology, newness, speed, but not work that's based on ideas. And it's important to realize that in the long run, all of those things I just mentioned will fade away, and the ideas are really, really all that you have left in the long run. And as I said a moment ago, I see a great potential in this community to become the great poets of today, the great communicators of today, but at the moment I see more a community that is full of tinkerers, hired guns, in some cases pixel pushers, and I think that's sad because I don't think it has to be like that. And this might be weird to hear, maybe you don't understand what I'm saying, but there are a few questions that I'm going to just go through now that I think can be useful to ask about your own work. There's certainly questions I ask about mine, and these might be useful. Can it make someone gasp or cry? Does it feel as special as a love letter? Does it truly represent our time? Will it feel relevant in 25 years? Does it say something that's never been said before? Does it compare to the masterpieces of other mediums? Could it have gone further? Finally, I want to share with you some insights that I've come across over the last 8 years or so, and they might be useful, so I'm going to just share a few of them with you. You'll become known for doing what you do. This sounds really obvious, but it's actually a useful thing to realize. I think too many people think that there's a rite of passage that has to be passed through before you can really start doing the work that you want to do. But what ends up happening is that you get stuck in that rite of passage, and you get known for doing a kind of work that you don't like, but you feel you have to do as a matter of course, and then you end up always doing that work. The way to escape that cycle is to start by doing the work that you want to do. And at first that means staying up until 2 a.m, not getting paid for it, and just doing it on your own time, doing it on the weekends, but that's what you have to do. And if you do that, and you provide a few compelling examples of what you can do, then you start to be known for doing that, and then people maybe will pay you for that, or they'll ask you to do that, and this ushers in a new space for you. So that's one thing. The personal is powerful. Personal experience is very powerful. Trust your experience. It's the only thing that you really know, and it's the only thing that you really have that's special to you, is what you've specifically gone through yourself. So put yourself in the work, make work that's about yourself, that only you could have made, and that's a good first step. Do your own thing. If you imitate other people, all you're ever going to become is a bad example of the thing that you're trying to imitate. What you need to do, and this is something Donald Judd said, who's an artist I like a lot, is that what you need to do is you need to find the same level of inventiveness as the person that you're trying to imitate. That's the only way. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't steal things. Another person, Picasso, said, bad artists copy, great artists steal. And what he means by that is that sometimes you see something that somebody else has done, and you know that that has to be somewhere in your work. And so what you should do is you should steal it, and you should make it your own, and then you should move on. You shouldn't try to copy the whole thing. You should just take that element that you need and incorporate it and keep moving. And then you do your own thing. I said this before, ideas are all that survive. Execution is very important too. If you have a great idea badly executed, it probably won't go anywhere. But you have to have an idea at the core. If it's all about execution, if it's all about surface and style, it's just not going to last. It's not going to reach anybody. And in 10 years, nobody's going to care. You need to have ideas. Experience is the only way to learn. This is more of a general thing about life and not so much just about making work. But pain, suffering, joy, fear, risk, you learn so much from this stuff. And it ends up affecting your work in ways that you don't even know when you're going through it. But you have to experience stuff to learn stuff. Don't take what other people tell you. You might end up reaching those same conclusions over time, but it'll be through having gone through that thing yourself. Only fools get trapped by tools. You have to remember that tools exist to serve you, not the other way around. I think that technology has overstepped its boundaries for a lot of our lives, not just people who do creative work, but just people in the modern world in general. There has always been this unspoken pact between tools and their owners, which is that you use a tool as you need it, and then you put it down, and you don't look at it again until you need it the next time. That's certainly how hammers and pencils and leaf blowers work. But for some reason, iPods and iPhones and computers do not operate this way. They insert themselves into our lives, and they ask so much of us, and they end up taking too much of a role, more than a tool should be allowed to. So you have to remember, use your tool for what you need it, and then leave it behind. Don't obsess over the tool. Also, the tool is not the idea. The tool is not the message. The tool is the language you use to say the message. You still need the message. Go outside. Leave technology behind sometimes. You need to go. You need to experience your world. You need to understand the community you live in, the type of people that are alive right now. That's how you figure out what you need to say. You go out and you experience life and you figure out what you need to say. Then once you've figured out what you're going to say, you can come back, you can pick up technology again, and you can produce the thing, you can execute the thing. But you're not going to come to the idea sitting behind a screen. I don't think. Certainly doesn't work for me. And finally, this is the crux of, if you can remember one thing from me today, it's this. Once you've learned to speak, what are you going to say? And I think at the moment, we have people here who are so good at speaking. In the sense of programming and design and all of this stuff, but very few people who have figured out what they're going to say with that language, with those skills. That's the thing that you need to figure out more than anything else. So that's all I've got. Thank you very much.